Chapter 2, Early February, 1980, Part 1. It amazes me, Kent, that you're walking as well as you are after that surgery, Charlie remarked, as he walked with a shackled Kent Chapman down a long hallway that led to a metal door. Outside the door, a prison van was idling. Two guards were positioned on each side of the opened back door. Kent underwent surgery a few days after Kevin Thompson had shot him at the beach house in North Carolina. A week after his surgery, he was flown across the ocean where the CIA guards released him into CIS custody. Charlie was with the guards who accompanied Kent in the following weeks to and from the prison in London, which was only a temporary home. After Kent was interrogated for his knowledge of the Serpent's network and procedures, he was transferred to HM Prison Wakefield. Wakefield seemed like a harsh punishment for someone who betrayed his country. Rated as a maximum security prison and located in Wakefield, West Yorkshire, England, it was home to those who committed the most heinous of crimes. Monster Mansion, as it was called, housed high-profile, high-risk sex offenders and murderers. Ken had protested his eventual transfer to this prison, hoping that his knowledge would lessen the charge and imprisonment. He couldn't have been more wrong. Kent shuffled down the hallway, still angry about his situation. "I still can't believe that you have the nerve to send me to Wakefield after all the help I have given you." "Yes, well, you were the one who chose to aid the Serpent. I don't know how you could have looked Sean in the eye all those years pretending to be his friend." Charlie really did find this the most distasteful part of Kent's charade. "You went through training together. It is beyond me how you can sleep at night knowing what you were doing to someone who would have taken a bullet for you." Kent scoffed at Charlie's remarks. In Charlie's eyes, Kent had become very bitter. Charlie's eyebrows lowered as he pondered whether the image of the cheery, helpful Kent was a facade and this bitter person was real. The two guards that had been following Charlie and Kent placed their hands on their holstered guns but relaxed when they spotted the prison guards with their semi-automatic rifles at the ready. Kent walked to open the doors of the van and the two guards helped him in and to a bench that was heavily bolted to the van's side wall. It was not designed for comfort. The guards strapped him to the bench, the leather strap around his waist. They secured his shackles to the floor with heavy bolts. They yanked a couple of times on the chains to make sure they were secure. Kent grimaced and cussed as the cuffs cut into his skin. There were no goodbyes exchanged between Kent and Charlie as one of the guards jumped into the back and the doors to the van were closed and locked. The guard who was the driver sauntered up to Charlie with a clipboard. Charlie looked over the paperwork and then signed it. Returning to the driver's seat, the guard got in and drove away. With that, Kent was on his way to the infamous prison. Jack Kensington, the CIS director, had no love for traitors. He had lobbied heavily for Kent to be sent to Wakefield, and he got his wish. Charlie wondered if it was a gross overreaction, but he also knew that most of the information Kent supplied was fictitious. Elliot, who worked closely with Sean, also knew that Kent was lying. Charlie shrugged his shoulder, indifferent to what would or could happen to Kent, and walked back into CIS headquarters. The van rambled down the road. No one in the van had any interest in conversing. It seemed like an eternity before they left London behind. Since Kent's transfer had happened late on this winter's day, daylight was waning. The guard in the back with Kent seemed to be struggling to stay awake. Kent silently observed both guards and then yawned. "You wouldn't happen to have any coffee stashed somewhere, would you?" Kent asked, finally breaking the silence. "This isn't a buddy airplane," the guard sitting across from him shot back. "No, that's obvious," Kent replied. The guard driving the van looked in his rearview mirror during this exchange but offered no additional commentary. The van continued to ramble along, each and every bump excruciatingly felt in the backsides of the three occupants. Kent was trying to determine what was worth, the endless rattling over bumps in the road or the foul odor ever present inside the van. They were a good hour into the trip when Kent finally nodded off. The guard across from him was finding it very hard to keep his eyes open. He repeatedly looked out the front window hole that separated the back compartment from the driver and his prisoners. Through the hole, the guard could see in the rearview mirror surrounded by the darkness of the evening. The whining of the wheels of the road added to the fight to stay awake. The guard shifted his look back to Kent, asleep, his mouth open, his head bobbing forward in rhythm with the van's movement. It was hypnotizing. The guard started to nod off but reawoke with a jolt of his head. He then went back to looking out the front window hole. In a split second, everything changed. The guard in the back had just nodded off when he felt a strange vibration that resonated through the seat. Kent felt it too, and he opened his eyes, confused by it. The strange vibration was rapidly followed by a loud bang, then a whoosh, and both men looked forward to see the driver grabbing the wheel in a desperate attempt to control the van. It swayed right and left as the driver applied the brakes to try and slow the vehicle. Just as the van was slowing, it took another violent swing to the left, the rear of the van seeming to catapult forward, just as a repeated firecracker sound was heard. The guard in the back looked forward into the rearview mirror to see the driver slumped in his seat and no longer in control of the vehicle. Blood trickled down the left side of his face, and within a second, the van started to roll over. Kent tried his best to shield his face. Unable to raise his hand, he lowered his head between his shrugged shoulders. He didn't have to worry about falling out of his seat. He was chained and strapped into the body of the van to ensure he would not escape. The guard who was sitting across from him was not so lucky. With each roll of the van, the sound of his head and body hitting the metal made a sickening thud. When the van came to a stop in the field a ways from the road, the guard was unconscious, lying across Kent's chest. The van was on its side. Kent's backside was horizontal with the ground. He lay in shock, listening for sounds outside the van. A few minutes later, he heard some whispered voices speaking French, and a smile crept across his face. The van's back doors opened. Five men, whose identities were shielded under black masks, stood outside. Without speaking, two men grabbed the guard and removed him from Kent's chest. Another man removed the keys to Kent's chains from the guard's belt and began to unshackle him. No one spoke. When Kent was free, the men exited the van. Four of the men were already disappearing into the darkness. Kent rubbed his wrists as the fifth man handed him a backpack. He saluted Ken and took a few steps backward before he turned and ran into the darkness. Kent looked around and listened. Did he hear a siren? Was the crash witnessed by anyone other than these five masked men? He heard nothing. He opened the backpack and peered inside. He smiled when he realized his orders had been carried out with precision. He had everything he needed to flee to England. He started off to find cover and disappear into the night. Blind Persuasion, Chapter 2, Part 2. As Nicole entered Jenkins' condo through the front door, she heard the phone ringing. She hurriedly put her purse and coat down and ran over to Jenkins' favorite chair, answering with a rushed hello.
"I'm sorry. I believe I've dialed the wrong number," a man with a British accent said.
"Who were you trying to reach?" Nicole responded.
"I was trying to reach Senator Robert Jenkins."
"You've dialed correctly. I'm afraid he isn't in right now. He's flying in from New Hampshire. I expect him any minute," Nicole said, trying to be helpful. I'm a sucker for a British accent, she thought. The man's accent reminded her of Sean.
How silly of me. I should have realized with his campaign for president that he'd be entirely too busy to help. The man seemed flustered.
"I don't understand," Nicole replied as she tilted her head. May I take a message or have the senator call you?
Well, I'm afraid that depends on who you are, the man answered with a chuckle in his voice.
I'm sorry, I'm Nicole Charbonneau, a friend of the senator's.
Nicole? This is Nicole? The man almost asked in disbelief.
Yes, Nicole confirmed, rather confused that the man seemed to know who she was and seemed excited about it.
This is Charlie Dawson, Sean Atkins' superior. Nicole, it's quite good to finally talk with you. I'm beginning to wonder if we ever meet.
Mr. Dawson, it's so very good to talk to you. Nicole sat down in Jenkins' chair. How is Sean? Is he doing well?
Well, I'm afraid that's why I'm calling.
Nicole didn't like the sound of that. The smile started to disappear from her lips.
I was wondering if Sean had been in touch with Bobby.
Not that I'm aware of. What's wrong?
He hasn't returned home, and we are beginning to worry about him.
He's not in England? Do you know where he is? Nicole asked, beginning to worry as well.
Oh, yes, we've been in contact. It's just that we expected him home by this time. I was going to ask Bobby if perhaps he could drop down to see him, since he was very helpful the last time.
Charlie was rambling. He rather enjoyed hearing Nicole's voice.
But that was foolish of me. I'm sure with his campaign, he will be entirely too busy.
You're referring to when the serpent killed Sean's wife and child, Nicole said, although her voice trailed up at the end as if it was intended to be a question.
Oh, he told you about that time.
Sean did, yes, Nicole confirmed. So you know where he is?
Yes, Charlie answered.
Can you tell me? Nicole prodded. Charlie was quiet for quite a few seconds.
Nicole, he finally started, I feel much better having this conversation with Bobby. No offense to you, my dear. It's just that I'm more comfortable dealing with the people I'm used to dealing with. If Bobby could find the time to call me, I would greatly appreciate it. I know he's rather busy, but perhaps he could refer me to someone who could help. Could you tell Bobby to call me? I'll be at the office for another hour, and then he can reach me at home.
Nicole was disappointed that Charlie was not going to divulge Sean's whereabouts. I'll tell Bobby to call you when he gets home. I really do expect him any minute. Charlie could hear her disappointment.
It has nothing to do with you, Nicole. If it's any consolation, Sean asks about you when I talk to him.
Nicole smiled when she heard this. If you talk to him again, please tell him I said hello, and that I'd be open to hearing from him.
Oh, dear. I'm not sure Bobby would like to hear that, Charlie responded with a hint of laughter in his voice. From what our papers have to say over here, you two seem quite the item.
Nicole laughed. And I thought following the royal family was your favorite pastime.
Touché, Charlie said. I have to say that Bobby certainly looks happy with you on his arm. Tell him to call me, and if I talk to Sean, I will pass along your message. Goodbye.
Charlie hung up the phone. Nicole thought for a moment, then did the same. Now she had to tell Bobby to call Charlie without sounding too anxious. If Sean was in danger or suffering, she wanted to help him. This was going to be tricky. She needed to think and was hoping Jenkins wouldn't get home too quickly. Unfortunately, that was not to be. She heard the garage door open and Jenkins' car pull in. She walked to the bar to pour them both a drink. She poured Jenkins a scotch, and Nicole opted for a glass of white wine. Jenkins entered from the garage and saw Nicole at the bar retrieving the wine bottle from the small refrigerator under the bar. He walked over to her, took her in his arms, and they kissed passionately.
I could get used to you living here, he said.
Although they were not living together, Nicole had a key to his condo and discreetly as possible spent the night with Jenkins when they could. The campaign commitments were grueling, and there were times when Nicole joined Jenkins at events. She thought it was best not to be a constant companion, which she hoped would keep the comments about their relationship to a minimum. Nicole just smiled, relaxing into his hug. She was well aware of the fact that Jenkins loved her more than she loved him. She wasn't sure how she felt about that, and she wasn't interested in pondering that thought any further. She did love Jenkins and was very attracted to him. She just wasn't in the position to give him any more than that after all that had happened. Her heart was still mending, and there were just too many questions left to be answered. Not to mention, there was this bond with Sean that she needed to figure out. Jenkins released her and looked at his watch. Nicole handed him his scotch, and she picked up her glass of wine. Jenkins took a quick swig and put the glass down on the bar. He started to walk away, loosening his tie as he walked. We don't have much time. The Barkers have invited us over for dinner. It seems there's something urgent that Larry wants us to discuss.
Discuss with us? You and me? Nicole questioned. She took a drink of her wine.
No, I'm sorry. Jenkins stopped, realizing his eagerness was causing confusion. He wants the Phenom Five, as you call us, to meet, Jenkins answered. I'm not sure what it's about, but Larry called about a half hour ago and asked that we come over for dinner. Actually, he didn't ask. He demanded. Jenkins headed towards the stair. I want to change my clothes. Bobby? Nicole interrupted him with a sense of urgency that caught Jenkins' attention. Charlie Dawson called here just before you got home. He'd like you to call him as soon as possible. Jenkins ran his fingers through his hair and then looked at his wristwatch.
Did he say what it was about?
It involves Sean, Nicole blurted out, almost before Jenkins finished his question. How come I can scheme to win court cases, but I'm terrible at this? She looked down at her wine glass and rested her body against the bar.
Did he tell you anything more? Jenkins asked, becoming a little irritated.
No, he said he wanted to talk to you directly. Nicole watched as Jenkins wrestled with what he should do.
Bobby, whatever Senator Barker wants can surely wait until we arrive. I doubt this will take very long.
Jenkins looked at Nicole.
Or I could call Charlie in the morning.
At this, Nicole gave him a scornful look that he had only seen a couple times before, including the night the Carol was killed.
Oh, all right. I won't get a minute's peace until I call him.
He walked over to the chair and sat down.
Don't you think you should call from your den? Nicole asked.
Why? You won't let me alone until I tell you everything, so I might as well make a call from right here.
Jenkins was not happy at all. The last thing he wanted was Sean back in their lives. In fact, he felt Sean was the reason why Nicole had not fully committed to their relationship. He could feel that slight bit of hesitation whenever he touched her or commented on how much he loved her. The tension between them intensified every time she mentioned Sean's name, and Jenkins was very aware of the jealousy and resentment that was growing within him. He picked up the receiver after locating Charlie's office number in a small black book of phone numbers he carried with him. He began to dial the number. After a few rings, someone picked up.
Hello, Charlie. It's Bobby Jenkins.
Nicole said you called.
Jenkins listened as Charlie thanked him for calling back so quickly.
It's my pleasure. What can I do for you?
Well, Bobby, it's a favor, really, and off the record. I was wondering if you could take some time to physically check on Sean for us, Charlie began. While he seems to be fine, he has yet to return to England.
He's not in England? Where is he? Jenkins asked, now concerned.
He's in a little place called Tryon, North Carolina. Are you familiar with that city?
Jenkins chuckled.
I hardly call that a city. How on earth did he get there?
That is on the other side of the state. What has you concerned, Charlie?
We'd like to have him back here as soon as possible. On a rather personal note, he hasn't sounded like himself. I'm afraid that he might be fighting some of those demons he was fighting when you were such a help to him.
It is easy to hide what is truly going on when you're talking on a phone, Charlie paused. There also has been an unfortunate development that requires his services urgently.
Jenkins sat quietly for a moment.
Charlie.
I'm not sure how quickly I can get down there. I'm thinking of my schedule with all the primaries, and North Carolina primary isn't until May.
Oh dear. That is too long to wait, I'm afraid.
Jenkins heard the worry in Charlie's voice. He glanced up to see Nicole intensely staring at him with a look of concern.
I'm late for a dinner meeting now. Can I call you again in the morning after I check my schedule?
I might be able to arrange something so that a pass through a small town won't look too conspicuous.
Jenkins listened as the hope in Charlie's voice grew.
Is there a concern about bringing Nikki?
Oh, not at all. I would expect that Sean would be happy to see her.
Do you have an address for him? Jenkins picked up a piece of paper and pen at the end of the table next to his chair. He wrote down the address and said goodbye, and he hung up the phone.
Without looking at Nicole, he stood up, placed the paper in his pocket, and announced, "Sean is in trial in North Carolina." "Where?" Nicole asked, having never heard of the place.
"It's a quaint little town in the foothills of the Smokies," Jenkins said as he walked to the stairs. Just before exiting the room, he finished with, "The Barkers were expecting us at 5:30. It was a few minutes past 5:30 when Jenkins finished the call. He walked upstairs to change. Jenkins also wanted to be alone, to rein in his emotions. Nicole smiled as she brought a glass of wine up to her lips. There was a chance that she would see Sean again. She felt a feeling of warmth in her chest around her heart that she hadn't felt in a long time. She was almost tingling with excitement. She took another sip of her wine. She knew she had to hide these feelings from Jenkins. She desperately wanted to see Sean, but if she appeared too anxious, Jenkins just might decide to go without her. She smiled at her thoughts. Of course Jenkins should know he would not be able to keep her from seeing him. She wouldn't let him. If he couldn't fit the trip into his schedule, Nicole just might go to try on without him. She took her last drink of wine. She knew she was going to see Sean, and it was going to be soon. Jenkins returned in a fresh suit and grabbed his coat and Nicole's off the chair. "Are you ready?" Nicole put her glass down on the bar. She turned to allow Jenkins to help her into her coat. "What's the topic of conversation tonight?"
"I have no idea what you lovely ladies will be talking about." Jenkins smiled as he thwarted Nicole's attempt to find out what the Phenom Five were going to discuss.
They exited the house to the garage. There was little discussion between them on the drive over to Barker's residence.
Blind Persuasion, Chapter 2, Part 3. Louise Barker walked with Jenkins and Nicole to the great room of their home, where the other distinguished guests were enjoying their drinks and discussions. Nicole was taken aback at first by the powerful members of Congress standing before her. She wasn't sure why this happened each time she saw them gathered. Senator Daniel Mercer, the majority whip of the Senate, was standing by the fireplace. His wife was standing beside him and in conversation with the House of Representatives Minority Leader's wife, Helen Connors. Her husband, Harry Connors, was talking with Mercer. They seemed to be commenting on the weather and the warmth of the fire in a pleasant conversation. Rounding out the Phenom Five, as Nicole referred to them, was the very powerful representative from California, Victor Alboreto, who was up for re-election in November, but didn't seem to be the least bit worried. Nicole had accidentally let her nickname for these five men slip in an interview, and now the media was starting to use it, much to the dislike of Senator Barker. The Phenom Five, Senator Larry Barker, Senator Daniel Mercer, Senator Bobby Jenkins, Representative Harry Connors, and Representative Victor Alboreto, were the most powerful Democrats in the nation, setting the platform for the Democratic Party. While Jenkins and perhaps Mercer could have the trait of modesty attributed to them, the others could not. Jenkins and Mercer didn't like their names associated with anything as vain as being called phenomenal. They preferred powerful. They acknowledged their roles in steering the Democratic Party and spearheading most of the legislation on which both chambers of Congress voted. Their relationship with the Republicans was on good terms. While their negotiations could be seen heavy-handed at times to those outside politics, it really was nothing more than good negotiating along with exploiting the person across the aisle's weaknesses. The power they wielded was also something that these five men did not want to lose in the upcoming election.
"Hello, Bobby."
"Hello, Nikki,"
Senator Barker called when he saw them enter the room. He walked over to shake hands with Bobby and give Nicole the typical bear hug that she despised intensely. This always seemed to bring a smile and constrained chuckle to Jenkins.
"Sorry we're late," Jenkins said. "We really need to figure out how to make DuPont Circle work someday."
"Thankfully, that doesn't fall under our jurisdiction,"
Barker said, adding a laugh at the end. Help yourself to a drink. I think dinner should be ready shortly, Barker said, then walked off to join Mercer.
Jenkins took Nicole's hand and walked over to the fully stocked bar to their right. A beautiful stained glass window was behind the bar on an exterior wall. It was an abstract, but if you looked hard enough, you could make out the Capitol building and its surrounding landscape. It was quite beautiful. Very subtle in color and design, it provided a calm, peaceful feeling for anyone who looked at it. Nicole indicated that she would like to have a glass of wine, which Jenkins poured for her. He then helped himself to Barker's single malt vintage scotch. Nicole whispered to Jenkins, questioning the topic of conversation among the Phenom Five, only to be thwarted again by Jenkins. With a smile, he reminded her that the topic among the ladies was up to them. You know, Bobby, the year's 1980, not 1880, Nicole said, making a not-so-subtle point that perhaps it was time to include women in the discussions.
How time flies, Jenkins shot back as he took a drink of his scotch to down his sarcasm. I have to say, I love this 1963 Glenmorangie. Would you like a taste?
He asked Nicole. She smiled as she knew he was trying to change the subject on purpose. Do you really think that what you men talk about is not discussed with their wives when they get home?
Nicky, I don't know, and I don't care.
In case you haven't noticed, we aren't married, and what others tell their wives is none of my business, Jenkins answered. He could tell his remarks hit a sore spot with Nicole. He also knew he was lashing out at her because of his resentment he was feeling over Sean. His responses to her since the phone call with Charlie had been sharp and snappy. Jenkins realized what he was doing when he watched Nicole's demeanor change. Her shoulders slumped slightly forward, a frown crossed her lips as she looked down at her wine glass. Jenkins sighed and softened his tone.
It isn't that I don't trust you. I do. It's just that what we discuss is meant to occur behind closed doors for a reason. It's like a war room. If the plans get out, then the enemy would be harder to conquer. There are just some things that are better left to just a few.
So democracy is expendable? Nicole responded, not looking up from her glass.
What we do is not a threat to democracy.
No one took the elections away, and no one will. We are here to represent those who elected us, and they expect us to do whatever we can to make sure that we represent them well.
Nicole looked at Jenkins in the eye.
Are you naive enough to believe that this secret plotting is what they had in mind when they cast their vote?
Jenkins smiled and shook his head in disbelief. You really think that the Republicans aren't doing the same thing?
I didn't say that. I'm talking about the everyday citizen, Nicole said. I know the Republicans are doing the same thing.
Jenkins was resentful. So you want us not to do this so that they can have an upper hand?
I didn't say that either, Nicole retorted.
It's the way it works, Nicky. I'm sorry if that offends you or the average citizen. We have strategies and we make plans. We have a platform that we work to achieve. They vote for the platform. We plot and discuss how certain legislation will affect the country and that platform. We vote our constituents' best interests. And above all, we negotiate in their best interests as well.
Jenkins took another drink of his scotch. Isn't that what a democracy is all about?
As long as you haven't forgotten that the negotiations are done with your constituents' best interest at heart, then I would have to answer yes, Nicole said, taking a drink. She didn't like losing.
I just don't like closed-door meetings, she finished. Jenkins gave a little laugh, looking at Nicole with a little gleam of love in his eyes. This was one of the things he did love about her. He wondered how she could disarm him so easily.
You just don't like being excluded from the conversation.
If we invited you into the meetings, you wouldn't see anything wrong with him. He walked out from behind the bar.
Nicole felt a little wounded and perhaps insulted.
I would not, she quietly protested. He gently took her arm as they walked to the center of the room towards the Mercers. He kissed her on the cheek, an action not missed by a couple of the wives who smiled longingly, remembering how their own husbands used to do the same thing.
I hate this little box you're putting me in, she whispered to him.
Look at all them smiling at me. I feel like I've journeyed back to the 1950s or something. Jenkins stopped and looked at Nicole. Nikki, we are the youngest people in the room. They are from the 1950s. They both laughed quietly at Jenkins' comment. We'll talk about your concerns after this evening is over. Don't expect any changes to happen, but I do want to hear why you feel I'm putting you in some kind of box. This truly did concern Jenkins, as he knew Nicole would never stay with him if she felt she just was someone who was on his arm to make him look good. This, of course, was at the root of his conundrum. How much could he trust her, knowing she had a sharp mind for politics and the law? How much would she put up with before she decided that he wasn't the knight in shining armor that she made him out to be? Would she be able to forgive him for all the times he decided not to disclose information to her, including the confession tape that was now securely locked in his safe? That information, she would feel, was something she should be privy to, and yet he couldn't bring himself to let her see it. 2 months after obtaining it, he still wasn't sure who to let in and what he should do with the tape. The power of knowing who plotted to kill President Andrews was seductive. Jenkins had been battling its seduction for months, and the power the tape wielded was still clouding his judgment. Could the country withstand multiple trials of treason? Could he withstand the political wrath if it were discovered that he had been hiding it all this time? It was like a sickness, witnessing how those who committed the act of treason behaved, secure in their belief that the secret had died with Norman Sipes. It was fascinating to watch, their brassness and egotistical belief that they had literally gotten away with murder enraged Jenkins. Still, he had to keep it to himself until he could determine the best way to use the information. He was bearing the weight of all this information alone. It's better this way, Jenkins convinced himself. He had forgotten there was someone else who knew the power the tape wielded and was growing restless in the shadows. Tony's ability to upset Jenkins's plan never entered Jenkins's mind. But Tony didn't forget, and his actions were being carefully planned. Jenkins was focused on one thing, the power that the tape would give him. The timing had to be right, and then he would use it to his advantage. He wanted desperately to start action against Jeffries for the murder of John Spencer. His lips curled in disgust when he thought about Jeffries. He hadn't realized he was showing his disgust on his face until Nicole asked if everything was all right. Her voice jolted him back to the present. He adjusted his tie with his free hand and cleared his throat. What were you thinking about? Nicole asked. It's nothing, darling, Jenkins said. Shall we join the others? Are you sure you're okay? Where were you? Nicole pressed. Jenkins smiled at her concern. I had a fleeting thought of John. I just get a little upset that we haven't put more pressure on Jeffries about the crash, something I will remedy tomorrow. I understand, Nicole said, placing her arm between Jenkins' arm and his body. She rested her hand on the crux of his elbow. They walked over to join the others who were standing by the fireplace. Shortly after exchanging pleasantries with everyone, the Barkers announced that dinner was ready to be served. They followed their host to the dining room, and the table was lavishly set, reflecting Louise's love of entertaining. The Barkers certainly exhibited the old school of Washington politics and yet seemed to be able to connect with the younger generation. Nicole couldn't put her finger on why or how. She thought it was because the Barkers seemed to be able to convince the public that their role was truly a service. Barker, along with Senator Mercer, had a way of calming the Senate and keeping the rogue senators in line, resulting in any drama being eliminated from the public view. Nicole had to admit that Jenkins also had that ability, but she chalked that up to his military background more than the charm that the three of them possessed. Jenkins was 25 years younger than Barker and 17 years younger than Mercer. In the 4 years that Jenkins had been a senator, he had managed to garner the trust of two men who had been in the Senate for more than a decade. Barker made no secret of the fact that he felt Jenkins was his apprentice, and Jenkins made no secret that he held Barker in the highest esteem. Baker's support made Jenkins' rise within the Senate possible. Let's not sit by our spouses, Louise announced as they entered the room, but let's do make sure we are boy girl, boy girl, boy girl, please. To start off, Larry will sit at the head of the table as usual. Her husband gave a little bow as he headed to his seat. Barker always conceded to his wife's wishes when it came to entertaining. Nikki, you can sit on Larry's right, she pointed to the chair, and Nicole hesitated slightly as she walked away from Jenkins. Anne, please sit on Larry's left. She finished directing everyone to their seats. Inevitably, married couples were sitting adjacent to one another. Sitting down, the hostess declared in a cheerful voice, Oh, well, I did try. Everyone gave a smile and acknowledged that she did indeed try. The Alborettos and Connors were who Nikki considered the lucky ones. They were sitting next to each other. Nicole felt like Jenkins was the farthest away possible. He certainly was far enough away not to be able to save her from any blunders she might make in front of Senator Barker or Ann Mercer. Nicole was not very comfortable with that thought. She looked at Jenkins seated across from her at the end of the table next to Louise. Well, I have to say, I'm very happy to be sitting next to this fine-looking young man, Mrs. Connor said as she took Jenkins's arm, causing him to blush. It was no secret that Mrs. Connors found Jenkins very attractive and sought him out at every party. There was only 5 years' difference between them. Representative Connors had apologized multiple times to Jenkins for his young second wife's behavior. Connors had divorced his first wife of 20 years, seduced by this young vixen who had now taken a hold of Jenkins's arm. It was no secret there was trouble between the spouses, and neither of them seemed to care that each had found comfort in other people's beds for fleeting moments of satisfaction. The one bed that Mrs. Connors sought but had not succeeded in securing was Jenkins's, and she didn't care who knew it. Jenkins, on the other hand, despised the woman for all her weaknesses and awkward flirting that usually left him feeling tongue-tied. It astonished him that a woman of distinction would behave in such a manner. There was no possible way to always blame it on alcohol, as suggested by Connors upon every apology. Mrs. Connors was never drunk when she made her wishes known to Jenkins or others. Louise took Jenkins's hand that was resting on the table into hers and squeezed it. Nicole would have thought that the two women were making a play if it weren't for Louise's age and, of course, her marriage and position in society. Nicole despised Mrs. Connors' actions. She could barely speak with Mrs. Connors and avoided having to do so. Nicole knew Louise's squeezing of Jenkins's hands was Louise's way of apologizing to Jenkins for placing Mrs. Connors and Jenkins together. However, Louise did intervene before Jenkins had a chance to pull his arm away or make a statement. Now, Mrs. Connors, while we all just adore this quiet young man, we must remember ourselves, or some of us will not be enjoying the pleasure of his conversation. While it was a subtle reminder that she was married and should conduct herself as such, it was a reprimand that she would not be welcome at the table if she did not conduct herself in an appropriate fashion. The not-so-veiled threat was quietly acknowledged. Mrs. Connors removed her arm, cleared her throat, and then placed her napkin on her lap. The comment did not keep her husband from staring her down. Nicole looked at Jenkins. He gave a quick smile and a wink. Nicole returned his smile, still feeling a mile away from him. It was an awkward moment that seemed to purposely linger on for a few minutes. Nicole noticed for the first time the pangs of jealousy that she felt when she saw Mrs. Connors grab her beau's arm. She had never been one to get jealous before. She wondered if her jealousy was a result of how she felt about him, or if it was a fear that he could at any time cheat on her. She acknowledged to herself that she didn't know him well enough to determine, without a reasonable doubt, if he were that type. She smiled as she thought about the times they had been apart. The campaign trips and long sessions in Congress were the main culprits. Granted, he could cheat on her at any time, but she still felt that Jenkins wouldn't put himself in that position. She smiled as she realized this and chided herself for her foolishness. It was quite clear to everyone that Senator Jenkins was madly in love with her. He was off the most eligible bachelor list in everyone's mind except hers and Mrs. Connors. The Barkers hadn't had time for the dinner to be catered, so Louise prepared the meal herself. She took the quiet moment to announce that she would appreciate a turned eye to the cooking. She hoped that everyone would realize that being among friends was the real treat. Waiting for the signal, her staff was at the ready to serve their guests. After her quick statement, Louise gave a nod to her butler, who disappeared into the kitchen. After a few seconds, their appetizer was in front of them, and all were enjoying pleasant conversation as well as the food. Nicole was being quiet, listening to the various conversations occurring around her. Jenkins noticed this and caught her eye. He tilted his head with a curious look on his face, as if to ask if everything was all right. She smiled and nodded quickly to reassure him. He then returned to his conversation with Alboreto. Louise noticed the gesture. She leaned over to Jenkins to start a private conversation with him. "I must say, Bobby, that I am so appreciative of how you fawn over Nikki." Jenkins took his napkins and tapped it around his mouth, hoping that it would in some way hide his embarrassment. He wasn't sure what to say. "You noticed that, have you?" "My dear boy, don't be embarrassed. That's a rare quality these days, especially in Washington," Louise started. "Most of us, meaning the wives, are reliving how our husband used to treat us before we said I do and the political life took over." She looked at Jenkins, who felt as if he was being judged in some kind of contest. "You really do love her, don't you? This isn't a game you're playing because she looks good on your arm and her credentials are perfect for the Oval Office." Jenkins had forgotten that Louise had a way of cutting through the charade that most congressmen and their wives typically danced around. In a way, Nicole was very much like Louise in that she lived her life the way she wanted to live it. Jenkins sat back in the chair a moment, realizing that Louise was a very strong woman, much like Eleanor Roosevelt. He looked at Louise and leaned forward. "I do love her very much." He paused a moment, then added, "If someone were to say to me that I could have my seat in the Senate or Miss Charbonneau, I would walk away from the Senate that instant." He could see Louise was astonished at his answer. "And then I would continue my run for the presidency," he finished with a wink. Louise couldn't contain herself. She let out a laugh that caught the attention of the whole room. "I'm so sorry. Something the senator said took me by surprise." "Please continue on with your conversations. It doesn't bear repeating. It's all in the context, you see." Jenkins acknowledged her comments with a slight nod of his head. When everyone had returned to their conversations, Louise looked at Jenkins. "I really like Nikki. Please do me a favor." "No, do us all a favor. Whatever you do, don't hurt her so much that she loses that love she has for you. Friendship is wonderful, but never give her a reason to stop caring." She looked at Nikki, then at her husband. "When you stop caring on the level of your soul, you stop loving in the way that you love her now. You won't know what I'm trying to say until you've lost it. So please, don't lose it. Nothing on this earth is more important than what you are feeling right now." Jenkins looked at Louise and wondered what Senator Barker had done to make his wife warn him about losing love. He wondered how Barker had hurt her and what he promised her to make her stay. He knew he stood a chance of losing Nicole. He hoped he could achieve his political dreams and keep these feelings alive. He smiled as he thought about how naive Nicole was to the devious transactions that occurred behind closed doors. He knew that she had this childlike idea that politics would clean itself up before it passed the point of no return. And yet here he sat with one of the darkest secrets of all time. In some way, he wished that Tony Schaefer never darkened his Senate office with his visit to deliver the videotape. Jenkins realized that it was like having J.R.R. Tolkien's One Ring in his possession. The videotape had its way of summoning evil and persuading him that maybe it wasn't a bad thing to have this knowledge. Ultimately, it could be used as power. Maybe he could use it to attain his dreams and then change the country's course to a better path. He shook his head slightly and smiled again as he heard himself say, "Who are you kidding?" "Bobby?" Louise put her hand on the senator's arm. "Are you feeling all right?" The sound of her voice snapped him out of his thoughts. "I'm sorry. Yes, I'm fine. I just lost some thought. Nikki and I had a wonderful conversation the other day, similar to this, and I was recalling something I said." He patted the corners of his mouth again and replaced the napkin on his lap. One of the servants removed the plate in front of him. "Thank you," he said quickly before returning to the thought he was sharing with Louise. "In light of your advice, I wish I had said something different now." He took a drink of water, hoping this lie would satisfy her and allow her to prattle on about something else. He was thankful when the conversation was interrupted by Senator Barker at the other end of the table.
"I just can't imagine you not practicing law, Nikki."
Barker's astonishment at Nicole's statement raised his voice a little higher in volume than he realized.
"Bobby, did you know this?"
"That Nikki is not going back into law? Yes, I knew that," Jenkins confirmed, giving Nikki a smile and a wink for support. "I suppose this conversation was brought on by her sharing that she left the law firm of Rosen, Schaefer, and Pruitt."
There was that man's name again. Was Tony Schaefer going to be his unseen nemesis? Nicole smiled and answered, "Yes, it was."
"So you won't be practicing law at all?" Louise asked Nicole.
"I don't think so. I thought that I might go back to the Department of Justice as a U.S. attorney again, but I'm not sure I'm up for trying some of the murder cases, if you know what I mean." Clearing her throat and trying to force from her mind the grisly scene of the serpent lying dead in his own blood on the beach house floor. She wondered if the feeling of fear the serpent had brought into her life, which was now her demon, would ever leave her. She picked up her glass and took a quick drink. Jenkins was intently watching her, ready to jump in if she needed him to do so. "So," she started with a more upbeat tone in her voice, "I'm shopping around to see what might interest me as a second career." Barker looked at Jenkins, who could tell Barker's mind was racing with possibilities. "I'm sure we'll be able to think of something for you," Barker said with a smile. Nicole looked at the senator, who was still looking at Jenkins. She looked at Jenkins, then back at Barker. The smile on her face began to disappear as she realized that these powerful men wanted to control her life, her decisions. "I'm not cut out for politics, as I've informed Tony Schaefer on many occasions."
"What don't you like about politics?" Representative Connors asked.
"It's not that I don't like politics or the idea of being a representative or senator."
"Or president," Louise chimed in with a gracious, encouraging smile.
Nicole acknowledged her comment with a slightly embarrassed smile. "Or president," she added. "It's that I don't think I could say anything tactful when presented with some of the blatant falsehoods by opponents. I'd be pretty blunt, and no one likes a blunt politician."
"I think Harry Truman would have disagreed with that statement," Representative Alboreto said.
"The whole idea just frightens me," Nicole stated. "I really don't think it's for me." "There are other ways to be involved without being in the spotlight," Louise added. She took her napkin from her lap and placed it on the table, symbolizing that dinner was complete. "We can talk more about this in the great room while the gentlemen conduct their business in my husband's study. The staff will serve dessert and drinks in each room, shall we?" Nicole watched as everyone took Louise's cue and placed their napkins on the table. They pushed themselves back from the table and stood. Nicole followed suit and waited as the women went in one direction and the men in the opposite. Jenkins reached the end of the table where Nicole was and walked over to her. "Is everything all right?" he asked, standing close enough to kiss her quickly.
"Yes, I think so," Nicole answered. "I feel like I'm just walked into a scheme concocted by you and Senator Barker."
Jenkins chuckled.
"I assure you, I have no idea what they are up to.
And then there's this feminist side of me that wants to be in that study with you just to prove a point."
Jenkins looked at Nicole, who couldn't determine what that look was saying.
"What?"
"I haven't seen that side of you in a long time. I miss it. That feistiness, that confidence that you had at the White House dinner where we first met has returned."
"I have forgotten it," Jenkins said.
"I hope to see more of it."
"Are you sure? Most men despise us feminists."
"Most men aren't as cocky as I am," Jenkins said with a smile.
"Now that could be taken a couple of ways," Nicole retorted, meeting his smile. Jenkins raised his eyebrows and gave her another quick kiss.
"See you in a little bit. Are you really going to discuss business?"
Yes, there's an election to win, you know, Jenkins said as he pointed her in the direction of the great room and gave her a little push. Go on now. Don't make me patronize you, he quipped with a twinkle in his eye and a smile on his face, knowing that was exactly what he was doing. Nicole shook her head, fighting the urge to laugh and yet feeling a surge of anger. Don't get used to this, was all she could say as she walked towards what felt like the lion's den, the wives of prominent men who many times in the past couldn't wait to pounce on the opportunity to belittle their own. Jenkins turned for the study, knowing he would indeed pay for his actions. Nicole would not let him sleep until she knew all that went on in the study that evening. He only hoped he could dodge the interrogation. Nicole entered the great room just after dinner drinks were being poured. On the coffee table was an assortment of liqueurs, sat on a spotlessly signed silver platter, meticulously centered to be just an arm's reach away from the pride. Nicole opted for Grand Marnier to go with the tort that was being served for dessert. She sat on the sofa next to Louise, who had motioned her to do so. The other wives were discussing shopping and other activities which Nicole found boring. It wasn't that she didn't like shopping. She just didn't like making it an all-day affair. She wasn't up on all the fashion news or who was dating whom in society. Nicole was stylish enough, never going unnoticed in a room. Other things, however, were more important and deserving of her attention. Now let's talk about what you should be doing, Louise stated. If you aren't going to practice law, perhaps then managing a charity or an assistant to an ambassador would be something that interests you. She was racking her brain trying to determine what would be of interest to Nicole. It needs to be something that the senator can point to as aiding his campaign. You know what I mean, something that provides both of you with an impeccable respect. It has to be something that you could champion as first lady. Whoa, Nicole exclaimed, trying to restrain a laugh. We aren't married yet. I think you're getting a little ahead of yourself. Nicole put her dessert plate down. I mean no disrespect, Louise. It's just that Bobby and I have only been together for a little over 2 months, and that's no guarantee that we're going to get married. The whole room went silent as the three other ladies gave a small but audible gasps. Almost simultaneously, the women in the room confirmed Louise's assertion that Jenkins was going to marry Nicole, much to Nicole's displeasure. Oh, my dear, Mrs. Mercer started. I have never seen Bobby more in love or blindly interested in anyone as he is with you. And as you know, he has the pick of all kinds of women, from actresses to activists. Oh, my stars, do you remember? She turned her attention to the other ladies. Was it his high school sweetheart that he brought to dinner here? Oh, now, Anne, she was a sweet young lady, Mrs. Alboreto said defensively. Yes, she was sweet and immature and out of her league, Mrs. Mercer retorted, moving her chest forward with each exertion. That was pretty terrible. It was a good thing that he brought her here to a dinner party before he had to take her to an important function. Well, she never made it to that function now, did she? Mrs. Connors chimed in with what appeared to be a coy smile, but Nicole knew there was something vicious behind it. No, no, he ended up going to the function all by himself, Mrs. Mercer confirmed. I almost felt sorry for him, but it would have been a complete disaster. Nicole sat and listened to the full litany of women that Jenkins had brought to various dinner parties and how each of them didn't measure up to some archaic set of standards that these women had concocted out of some perverted opinion of motherhood. They were more like wolves in sheep's clothing than respectable ladies. She wasn't sure what they were really like exactly, except that, given the chance, they could tear any other woman apart. It made her stop and wonder what they really thought of her. It wasn't the first time that she had witnessed this behavior. For some unknown reason, women had to belittle other women. It explained why she preferred the company of men. On the other hand, she hadn't really kept up with every woman that Jenkins had dated. This afforded her a quick education. Other than the high school sweetheart, the list was pretty impressive. And you all believe that after that long list of women that you just berated, that Bobby would be interested in settling down with me? Nicole asked. There was a small, pregnant pause.
as a subtle insult of the word berated hung in the air. Nicole had more to say on the topic, but felt that she had made her point with that word. Finally, Louise spoke up. Nicky, all of us are very much aware of how he looks at you, and even this evening, when you talked about trying murder cases, he was ready to jump to support you. He has never done that with any of the women we've been discussing here. He has used dinner parties with us before to test out the women he has been interested in, and we have never uttered a word of approval or disapproval about any of them to him. I believe that most of the women he has been with have fallen short in his own eyes, not ours. Louise took a drink of her cognac. We are merely saying that we don't think this is going to be the case with you. Nicole finished her Grand Marnier and placed the glass down on the table in front of her. I apologize if my choice of words offended any of you. I feel like I should explain something to you. I am sure that you are aware that I'm a feminist. She could almost hear the distasteful groan the women were choking back. I realize we are from different generations. I also realize that standing behind your man is very important to you, and I commend your strength and willingness to do so. What I can't commend is the need to discredit other women based on some outdated standard. I just am not that kind of woman. I believe in our ability to be just as successful as any man. I believe that we should be paid the same wages, granted the same opportunities. And if you think that I didn't bring that belief to the table at my old job, just ask Tony Schaefer how many scars he has as a result of not meeting that belief. The ladies laughed. It is not good for us to attack our own. We should be enabling our own. The women you talk about already knew they weren't approved of before they even left here. I have to say that you have me wondering what you think of me and whether I'll pass that test. But frankly, I don't really care what you think or what you'll tell your husbands about me. If Senator Jenkins doesn't want to see me again because I don't meet your standards, well then, he's not the man I want to be with either. I don't know about your lives with your husbands, and I don't know about your sacrifices. But if you were given the opportunity, and if you have daughters of your own, don't you want their lives to be different? They are different than ours, Louise answered. And you are just as proud of them as your mothers were of you, I would imagine, Nicole stated. Of course we are, Mrs. Mercer chimed in. Nicky, I think you were wrong not to consider running for office. Yes, you're blunt and honest, and that probably won't sit well with a lot of people. But I think once people get to know you, it could be a blessing for this country. I thank you for that, Mrs. Mercer, Nicole said. But I'm rather interested in hearing about other opportunities. She couldn't resist her next statement. Besides, if I marry Senator Jenkins, the last thing I want is to oppose my husband for a Senate seat. All the ladies laughed at her comment. Blind Persuasion, Chapter 2, Part 4. The discussion in Senator Barker's study struck a different tone. All five gentlemen were of serious mind. It was an election year, and one of their own was in the running. Even with the amount of power Jenkins had obtained, he was generally admired and liked by the other four men. Jenkins never paid attention to the gossip about him being the most eligible bachelor on Capitol Hill. He prided himself on his honesty and his skill of negotiation. When he entered the study, he honestly thought the topic of conversation would be his campaign strategy. He was not prepared to witness what was about to occur, the unsavory display of a Washington power play.
"Connors, have a seat," Barker said as he sat down. "No, sit over here."
Barker pointed to the chair with its back to the fireplace, which Jenkins referred to as the hot seat.
"Please close the door, Bobby." Jenkins was the last to enter the room.
"Yes, of course," Bobby said as he closed the door. Jenkins saw Connor in the hot seat and at first thought his wife's flirting with him was the reason. "Larry, if this is about..."
"It's not," Barker cut him off mid-sentence.
He pointed that he wanted Jenkins to sit next to Mercer and proceeded to pull his pipe from a drawer. Jenkins sat down where he was instructed and gave Mercer a confused look. To everyone outside the group, Barker seemed to be the most powerful of the five men. The Texan's voice alone could cause anyone's knees to buckle when he turned his attention their way on the Senate floor. Jenkins watched as the spectacle occurred numerous times. He admired Barker's patience, waiting for the precise moment to catch his opponent in an indefensible position. There was an awkward moment as the four men waited for Barker to speak. Mercer, as the majority whip in the Senate, spoke first. "I believe we're gathered here to adjust a breach of protocol for this group. Is that true, Larry?" Barker fiddled with his pipe, cleaning out the bowl. "There are cigars for anyone who would like one." He was letting the tension grow in the room. No one moved. Barker put the pipe to his mouth and drew in a breath. Satisfied that the pipe bowl was sufficiently cleaned, he reached for his bag of pipe tobacco.
"Connors, Mercer is correct. We are here to discuss a breach, but not just in our protocol."
Jenkins was confused. He didn't remember a protocol existing between the five men. There were some unwritten rules, a code of conduct, but he would hardly go as far as to call them protocol. Maybe it was his military background that brought about the confusion. Nothing had ever been written down or about these meetings. Barker continued, "I consider this a breach in ethics, and you had better be glad that I'm not bringing this to the Senate floor." As Barker spoke, Jenkins watched the blood drain from Connor's face. He became almost ashen white.
"I can see by your reaction you know exactly what I'm talking about."
Connor sat for a moment, trying to formulate his defense in his head. Connors had held, and still did, a block of representatives in the northern states, the Rust Belt. These were the industrial states with strong unions. Connors, who represented Detroit, Michigan, with its large automotive corporations, was not happy with Jenkins's stance on drilling in the Anwar. Jenkins was heavily backing the new corporate average fuel economy, CAFE, standards, one of the key platforms in his campaign, using it to defend his stance of no drilling for oil in the Anwar. Detroit wanted the drilling and did not want the new CAFE standards. The day after Jenkins' campaign speech in May, where he referenced his support for the CAFE standards, Connors appeared on the Senate floor denouncing the standards and blatantly condemning Jenkins' position.
"If you are referring to my speech..."
"That is partly what I'm addressing here," Barker interrupted.
"Now, Connors, I thought this business about drilling in the Anwar was behind us. The bill was set aside for now."
"Yes, it has been set aside, but our young friend here is pushing a bill with higher CAFE standards, and some of my constituents are not happy about that."
"You mean some of your campaign's biggest contributors, don't you?"
Jenkins accused.
"They are one and the same. I represent them, and they expect me to do my job, and they will also be contributing to your campaign," Connors answered through gritted teeth.
"Sometimes doing your job is not doing what is good for an industry, but is ultimately good for the people and the environment," Jenkins charged. "The standards are not that far of a stretch, considering the Japanese are very close to reaching them with their automobiles. And we both know the corporations will give more money to the GOP. In case you haven't noticed, Hotshot, the American people are not interested in smaller, more efficient cars, Connors shot back, slightly more irritated. And my constituents work in the automotive industry, so I'm not just talking about white-collar jobs.
You believe that to be true? Jenkins asked. If that is the case, then why bother with CAFE standards at all? We'll just let the Japanese enter the market with high fuel-efficient cars. As oil prices rise because of the impending embargo, we will see how quickly the American car companies see their sales tumble. When they do, they will come begging for a bailout from the government.
Jenkins shook his head. His usual southern charm abandoned him when he raised his voice in anger.
For God's sake, man, get your head out of your ass and do these dinosaurs a favor. Tell them to cinch up their belts and get with the program.
Connors could not stand it when someone younger than him thought he had all the answers. You really think it's that easy? Connors yelled back. Where do you come off telling an industry how to run its business? They have tons of research showing what Americans want. Just whose head is up their ass? My job isn't telling the industry what or how to make their products, and it sure as hell isn't your job either.
Bobby's right, Barker interjected, just as Jenkins was about to answer. The automotive industry is changing, and they better open their eyes to the fact. We are on the brink of another oil crisis. We have got to end our dependence on foreign oil. I'm sorry, Connors, but your automotive friends need to wake up and understand we are not impressed with their lack of action.
And I'm telling you, my friends, if you want their backing for this election, you better kill this CAFE standards bill. You also better delay any discussion of Encilica until after the election. Connors was adamant.
Barker didn't like being threatened, especially by a junior statesman. He lit his pipe, staring at the representative. He blew the smoke out of his mouth slowly as he contemplated his answer. This was done to calm his anger, although most in the room thought it was to add to Connors' nervousness.
You realize that you are a part of our little cartel because we believe that you are a strong representative who would be able to convey our direction to the automotive industry, and not the other way around.
It sounds like they are controlling you. Is that the case? If so, what do they have on you?
Barker had cut to the chase. Of course, he had heard the rumors and withheld this information from the others. Jenkins wasn't even aware of any misconduct. Barker, as well as the other three gentlemen, stared at Connors as sweat beaded up on his forehead.
How did you know? Was all he could muster.
Connors began to tremble. His white-knuckled fingers wrapped around the arms of the chair as he tried to calm himself.
Know what? Barker asked calmly. It was clear to everyone in the room that Barker had something on Connors.
Connors smirked. You have obviously been told something.
I have. However, I want to hear it from you, Barker answered.
Connors stared at Barker.
I'd rather do this privately, he pleaded.
As you know, what is shared among us stays among us, Barker gave a quick glance to the others, saying, if any of you do not want to know, then you may leave and join the women in the other room. However, as you know, Representative Connors, to be here is quite an honor. Helping to steer the party's direction is quite an honor. Our behavior should be above reproach, Barker reminded him. You have a responsibility to tell us.
Connors swallowed hard as he dropped his head in shame. A few months ago, I was treated to a night on the town by the automotive big three.
It was quite a night, Connors said as he tried not to laugh. I need you gentlemen to promise me that my wife never finds out.
Alboreto put his drink down on the table. He stood, moving away from Barker, to lean against the floor-to-ceiling bookcase in the back of the room. To make it short, I was unfaithful. There are pictures. I had a lot to drink.
You weren't just drinking, Barker charged.
No, I wasn't just drinking. There was some drugs, some cocaine, Connors said shamefully. But I can handle this.
Jenkins looked down at the floor. Mercer looked directly at Connors.
No, you can't, Barker said. And we won't handle this for you. You will check yourself into a rehab program. You are going to confess to your wife what you have done.
You will announce tomorrow that you are going into rehab and counseling with your wife.
Barker put the pipe and the ashtray on the table in front of him.
You know that'll cost me the election, Connors exclaimed.
Larry, Jenkins started. It's going to be a tight race in the House. I don't think we can afford to lose that seat.
We'll lose it anyway when this comes out, and we all know it will come out eventually, Barker stated flatly. It is actually better for you to do it now, and maybe we can tap someone in your party for your seat that may be able to rebound from your mistakes. In any case, I will not have the automotive industry thinking they have you in their back pockets and through you control over all our actions. That just isn't going to happen, Barker declared, standing up. Am I clear? He looked at Connors.
This job, Connors started. My service means everything to me. I beg you not to do this. I'll lose my family.
Barker gave a small laugh. You didn't think of that before you snorted cocaine and cheated on your wife?
He paused for a second before he yelled,
Damn it, Harry! We stood in this very room and pledged to be above this type of thing. We didn't want to be in a position where bribes could play into our decisions.
Jenkins looked at Barker. His mind quickly churned up the image of the pledge that was made in this very room 3 years ago.
Damn that tape, Jenkins thought to himself.
He knew it was only a matter of time before he had to at least inform Barker and Mercer of its existence. He knew it was the key to toppling the current Republican stronghold. He still worried about its impact on the American people. It was a slippery slope, and no one was going to be the clear winner. Jenkins looked at Connors and swore the man was close to tears. Barker's voice pulled him back to the current situation. Would you like to tell your wife here with our support or alone?
Larry, Jenkins was appalled by Barker's question. Let the man have a little dignity.
He doesn't have any left, in my opinion, Barker answered. I have to side with Bobby on this one. Harry, go home with your wife and have the discussion, Mercer commanded.
Can we trust you to do it? Barker asked. Were you ever going to tell her? Were you ever going to tell us?
I was trying to make it go away, Connors answered, downing the rest of his dinner cognac. I'll leave now. As you can imagine, I'm not feeling so well. It was Connors' attempt to see if there was any support in the room.
Let me know if you need any assistance, Barker said as he watched Connors walk to the study door.
Connors didn't even acknowledge the comment. He walked out of the study to the great room. Meanwhile, back in the study, Barker had just sat down. The room was still quiet. Jenkins's thought was still on what and how he should deal with the tape. As the election heated up, the investigation was going to draw more attention. The silence was finally broken.
How did you know? Alboreto asked Barker.
I received a phone call from one of the CEOs. He started talking to me like I had already agreed to something that Connors told him I had agreed to. The details don't matter. I was intrigued and played along. During the conversation, I made a comment about how he got Connors to change his position. He was all too willing to tell me about the evening they had and actually offered to do the same for me the next time I was in Michigan.
Barker adjusted his jacket. Of course, that won't be happening. There was a short pause.
There is one more concern before we call it a night. Some of us here, myself included, had pledged strong support for Sanford before Bobby entered the race. I think over the coming weeks we should make it clear that we are backing Bobby.
Jenkins looked at Barker.
That would be much appreciated.
He smiled. The gentlemen raised their glasses in a toast and drank from the glasses to seal the sentiment.
It's been a long night. I think we all should adjourn, Barker stated.
Yes, I think that would be a good idea, Alboreto seconded. This was quite a shock. I'm sure the ladies are wondering what happened.
Jenkins smiled again. I'm sure I won't get a moment's peace until Nikki knows what happened.
Yes, well, I think we can let them in on it. Mrs. Connors is going to need some support over the next few weeks. Louise knew what was going to happen, so it would be best if they all knew.
Barker said as he walked to the door of the study and opened it.
Just make sure Nikki knows not to make any statements to the press.
I don't think we have to worry about that, Jenkins reassured Barker. When she returned from her ordeal in North Carolina, she dodged the press very well. With them constantly hounding her during this campaign, she has no love for them. The men laughed at the comment. Alboreto actually pitied the press. He didn't like strong women, which explained why his wife hardly ever said a word in public. I hope what happened here this evening won't come back to haunt us. He knows a lot about our strategies, and he could use it to our dismay.
We've done nothing to be ashamed of, or to hide. At least I know I haven't. Have any of you? Barker turned down the hall, not waiting for an answer.
Jenkins quickly followed him, with Mercer and Alboreto right behind. The gentlemen entered the room, where it was announced that the business was done for the evening, and that there were some early committee meetings that they needed to attend in the morning. The Alborettos were first to leave, followed by the Mercers. Jenkins helped Nicole with her coat, and then turned to accept his coat from Louise.
Good night, Jenkins said as they walked out into the cold air. He put his arm around Nicole as they walked to the car.
That was an interesting evening.
Yes, it was strange, Nicole replied, as they arrived at the car. Jenkins opened the passenger door. Nicole got in. Jenkins walked around to the other side, waving a final goodbye to the Barkers, who waited for him to start the car before they closed the door and turned the porch light off. Jenkins pulled away from the curb and headed for his condo. After a few minutes of silence, Jenkins finally asked,
"Why did you think it was strange?"
"It seemed like they had my next career determined for me without even asking," Nicole answered. "And I've never seen anyone look as pale as Connors did when he came out of the study. I don't think he was sick. He looked scared."
"I should know. I know what scared looks like."
Jenkins smiled at her last comment.
"I won't argue with that. He was scared. Or should I say, he is scared."
Nikki looked at Jenkins. Without having to ask, he continued, "Connors will be announcing that he is entering rehab in the next couple of days."
"What?"
"He's no longer part of the Phenom Five, a decision made by Barker that I hope doesn't come back to haunt us."
Jenkins paused, and Nicole waited for him to continue.
"It seems Connors had a little too much fun at the expense of his automotive Bacchus. They plied him with drinks, cocaine, women, photos and film at 11 if he didn't do what they wanted him to do." This was enough for Nicole. She turned her head and looked out the window. "I don't know if I should feel sorry for his wife or wonder if she will even care about him."
"It's going to be difficult for her," Jenkins stated, "although we know it was not the first time he strayed."
"You seem awfully detached from this," Nicole accused.
"He is not exactly my best friend, Nikki," Jenkins answered. "He was getting to be a bit too high and mighty. I didn't appreciate his attack last week regarding the cafe standards. In case you haven't noticed, the five of us don't attack each other in public."
He paused. "I should have known something was up. Barker ended up getting a call from a CEO. Connors was being bribed to get us to back off of the cafe standards and provide other incentives."
"Are the five of you your own ethics committee?" Nicole asked, implying that they were holding themselves above reproach.
"In a way, I guess we are. This stays between us, by the way. When we formed our little cartel, we knew we would have to stay clean, so to speak. As clean as any politician can be these days. I'm not really sure how good we are doing with that. What Connors did was way over the line. No one is perfect. We all make mistakes, but we shouldn't have corporations blackmailing us."
"I'm curious. Barker and Mercer don't know everything you know, do they?" Nicole asked.
"Like what?"
"Your relationship with Sis, Sean, and Charlie, for example. What do they know about that?"
"That I have a couple sources there. I never name them, and they assume it is part of my duties as chairman of the Intelligence Committee. They don't ask, I don't tell."
"That's what I mean, though. So you could have all kinds of secrets, and that's okay, because it's not a need-to-know thing?" Nicole was trying to wrap her mind around what was right and what was wrong when it came to the standards of the Phenom Five.
"Is that a question?" Jenkins asked.
"Sort of,"
Nicole answered. Jenkins wasn't sure what she was referring to, but he knew he had to choose his word carefully.
I'm sure I'm not the only one who has not placed all of his cards on the table.
Nicole decided she was never going to get Jenkins to tell her all she knew. She wasn't sure she wanted to know. They rode the rest of the way home in silence. Nicole entered the condo. Jenkins closed the door behind them. She unbuttoned her coat and threw it on a chair by the foyer. I need to ask you something. Was tonight some sort of test?
Test? I'm not sure I understand. Jenkins took off his coat and hung it up in the closet. Did something happen?
Nicole walked over to the couch and sat down. Jenkins moved toward his favorite chair. Would you like something to drink? He asked while he was standing. Nicole shook her head and Jenkins sat down.
Well, I had the honor of hearing about all the other women you have brought to those dinners. Nicole was being a bit sarcastic. The long list included your high school sweetheart, who evidently didn't make the right impression. And I had no idea that you even dated a few Hollywood starlets.
Jenkins took a deep breath.
It was not a test, and I'm sorry that you had to endure that. It must have been very hard to hear.
He paused, thinking about his high school sweetheart.
It is a shame, really. My old high school sweetheart is just that, a sweetheart of a person. She didn't like it here, and honestly, she never would have liked it here. We both grew up and have gone all different ways. She's married now, and I believe has two children. She's quite happy. She even told me in the last Christmas card that she sent that she was glad we split up.
Ouch, Nicole said with a laugh.
Jenkins laughed, too.
Yeah. I think I understand why she had to say that to me now.
It was also surreal. I mean, I'm sitting there listening to them list every woman you have been with, and I'm thinking, why am I here?
Nicole paused and looked at Jenkins. I mean, really, Bobby, if you can have someone like Jennifer Anders... He cut her off. Jennifer Anders was a gorgeous Hollywood starlet who had adorned the arms of Hollywood's most attractive and sought-after men.
We weren't exactly right for each other, Jenkins interrupted.
Don't get me wrong, Jennifer is very sweet and a very beautiful woman, but we just didn't click.
I think that's the expression that is used. Jenkins looked at Nicole.
Did they also recall how long I was with each one of these women?
No, not really. They just said that you were with them long enough to bring them to one of the dinners so that you could seek their approval, Nicole answered.
Nikki, I don't understand. Jenkins' brow was furrowed. Are you jealous of these women?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I know you were called the most eligible bachelor on Capitol Hill for a reason.
Did it ever occur to you? Jenkins paused for a moment, wondering if he really wanted to say it. He started over. Did it ever occur to you that these women weren't interested or in love with me because of my missing leg?
Startled, Nicole looked at Jenkins.
No. Is that true?
Some of them, yes. Thought I was some kind of a freak. And to be honest, I was not exactly in the same place I am now. I had nightmares. I was wrestling demons through some of those relationships. Some women can only see the lack of something, whether that be physical or mental, Jenkins explained. I'm not proud to say this, but my interest back then was to have someone on my arm, like Jennifer, to prove to others as well as myself that I was desirable. So the reputation of being the most eligible bachelor didn't come from me being the most desirable. Actually, it was quite the opposite.
There was a long silence as Jenkins worked up the courage to ask,
Does it bother you?
Does what bother me? Your missing leg? Nicole wanted to confirm before she answered. Jenkins, for the first time, looked vulnerable to her.
No, she answered as soon as he began to nod his head.
It's perfectly understandable if it does, Jenkins said, still looking at her. She never took her eyes from his.
It doesn't bother me, Bobby. There is so much that I love about you. Those things by far overshadow your missing leg. I thought those other relationships ended because you dumped them. You never complained about your leg, and aside from the slight difference in the way you walk, no one would even know. There is so much more to you.
I was attracted to you for a number of reasons. She paused. I never gave it a thought, really. Jenkins smiled and breathed a small sigh of relief. Thank you, he said gently. Now back to your question of why you were here with me. I have to say, I fell in love with you the first night we formally met. You were fearless, intelligent, and I had watched you from afar at previous dinners. I had always wanted to meet you, but didn't have the courage to introduce myself. When we finally did meet, the way you handled yourself in that high-pressure situation made quite an impression on me. Yes, I'll admit that your beauty was what first attracted me to you. I was so nervous when I saw you switch those names at the table. Nicole gave a little chuckle, remembering that moment. You hit it very well. Thank you. I wanted to appear confident. Evidently, I succeeded. Jenkins smiled. When you took on Johnson, with your comments about Ancilla, well, that's when you got me. I knew then that you were not only gorgeous, but highly intelligent. To me, that combination, I can't resist it. So the fact that I'm a feminist doesn't bother you? It irritates the shit out of me, Jenkins said, not missing a beat. But I wouldn't have it any other way. I don't see how you couldn't be a feminist. You are far too intelligent, brave, and beautiful not to make a difference for the women in this world. So don't be in such a rush to figure out what you want to do next. Recover from the last few months, and when you're feeling up to it, tackle what you want to do with the rest of your life. I know one thing, Nicole started. I don't want anyone deciding for me what I'm going to do. I won't, Jenkins answered. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about those women tonight, Nicole said. Jenkins laughed. Don't worry. They will be busy supporting Connor's wife and stabbing her in the back when she isn't around, Jenkins retorted flippantly. You see? Nicole almost shouted. That really pisses me off. I'm not telling them to do it, Jenkins defended himself. I know. We don't need men to destroy us or our confidence. We have other women who will do that rather well, Nicole exclaimed. It's not Mrs. Connor's fault that her husband was weak and a bit of an asshole, and yet we blame her and tear her apart for her so-called part in it. Of course, her infidelity will only add to all the gossip. They will talk about how weak she is and how she brought this on herself. And then there's this part of me that thinks she's only going to get what she deserves for her part in bringing down his first marriage. Nikki. It isn't like men don't attack other men. Look around. Look at the attacks on the campaign trail, Jenkins responded. Yes, but you're in politics. Oh, so just politicians do this. Think again, my dear. What do you mean? I've seen it everywhere. It's a feeding frenzy. It isn't just women on women or men on men. I've seen CEOs do it. I've seen best friends all their lives turn on one another. It is part of human nature. It's flawed human nature, Nicole said. I won't disagree with that. Regardless of where they are in society, when someone feels their power is being threatened or taken away, their first instinct is to fight. They want to injure them mentally or physically. Show the least bit of weakness and watch out. You are the next victim. Wow, where did that come from? Nicole asked. Too many years being a politician is where that came from. Then why stay a politician? Because I truly believe that I can make a difference, Jenkins answered. The day I believe I can't make a difference is the day that I will leave this profession. We have to make some hard decisions, or we're going to lose this country. He looked at Nicole. The Phnom Five talked briefly about this a few years ago. We all can see this happening. We want to stop it. Jenkins paused for a moment, remembering again what he had in his possession. And I have some very hard decisions to make in the coming weeks, he mumbled to himself. What was that? I didn't hear you. It's nothing important. It's getting late. Jenkins stood up and retrieved her coat. I'll call you in the morning. Nicole stood up and walked to Jenkins. You saw reporters? You didn't? Jenkins answered with a smile. Damn them. Nicole smiled and kissed him goodnight. They walked to the front door where Jenkins gave her another kiss. He stood in the doorway as Nicole quickly walked to her car.
You're breaking our heart, Nikki, one reporter yelled. Can't you spend just one night? Just once?
Good night, Nicole said as she got into her car. Sorry you had to wait out in the cold so long. She shut the car door, started the engine, and drove off. Jenkins shut the door to his condo when she was safely out of sight.
Blind Persuasion, Chapter 2, Part 5.
In the darkness of the moonless sky, the pulsing noise of a military helicopter's engine drowned out the peaceful rhythm of the ocean waves. The copter's pilot was checking his radar while a co-pilot looked through the windows with a pair of binoculars. In the belly of the copter were 5 Navy SEALs waiting for the command to carry out their orders.
It's like looking for a needle in a haystack, the co-pilot remarked to the pilot. This must be some big-name drug dealer to force us out here on a wild goose chase.
I heard the command came down from POTUS himself.
When we wake up in the morning, we'll read about it in the paper, the pilot joked as he did a visual scan. He heard a bleep and he looked down at the radar.
Check out your 3 o'clock, the pilot told his co-pilot.
The co-pilot looked through his binoculars as the pilot turned the chopper.
Vita Mia, that's it, the co-pilot explained. Does any of this strike you as odd?
It's not our duty to question orders, the pilot answered.
And he called back to the SEAL team to prepare for deployment.
The Vita Mia was a 45-foot sailing yacht. In Latin, the name translated to My Life. The yacht was spotted off the coast of Key West. And as the copter approached, the pilot made an observation he felt he should share.
Copter pilot to SEAL team commander?
Go ahead,
commander answered.
Looks like this target has run ashore. Do you want to deploy on land or directly aboard ship?
The order is on ship.
Affirmative, the copter pilot answered. Prepare to board.
The leader of the SEAL team gave the thumbs up to his men. They moved into position as the copter hovered above the yacht. The pilot was correct that the yacht had been scuttled onto a small barrier island that had been underwater at high tide. After boarding the yacht, the 5 Navy SEALs searched the boat for the captain, finding a dead body on the counter in the galley of the ship. The man's face was bludgeoned with blood soaking his white shirt and hair. There was blood on the counter and on the floor. One of the SEALs pulled the dead man from the counter onto the floor.
Sir, making a positive ID is going to be difficult, he said.
The commander walked over and looked at the white-haired man.
That white hair is good enough for me. The commander walked back out onto the deck and waved to the crewman on the chopper.
He lowered a large, fully packed duffel bag.
Let's plant this shit and get out of here, the commander ordered 2 of his men.
He returned to the galley and instructed the 2 men to ransack the galley and to wrap the dead man's body in the white sheets from the bed. The commander then started to look through drawers and what he considered hiding places, tossing the contents onto the floor. He looked for a safe but did not find one. When the contents of the duffel bag were securely hidden and the yacht looked even more ransacked, 3 of the 5 Navy SEAL members returned to the copter. A few ropes were lowered, 1 by each of the 3 men, and were tied around the dead body. The final 2 SEAL team members scurried up to the copter. The commander ordered the copter pilot to head out to sea. The copter rose, clearing the body from the deck, and turned to head out to sea. The SEAL team commander peered between the 2 pilots looking at their radar.
How deep would you guess this area to be? He asked the pilot and pointed to a position to the left on the radar screen.
Pretty deep, the pilot answered, not knowing the depth off the top of his head.
Head over there, the commander ordered. The pilot didn't acknowledge the order verbally, but he did turn the copter and head it for that spot. The commander watched as the deep water drew near. He walked to the open door of the copter and peered out. Let him go, he ordered the three SEALs, who were holding the ropes with quite some effort. They had braced themselves with special vests and ropes tied to the copter to keep them from falling out the door. Upon the command, the three ropes were thrown out the open door, and the body dropped into the ocean with a large splash. We're done here, the commander told the copter pilot. Let's return home. Returning home, the pilot confirmed, looking at the co-pilot. The copter turned and headed back to the mainland. Upon returning to the base, the Navy SEAL team commander reported to their superiors that their mission was successfully accomplished. They were then dismissed and ordered to get some sleep. Since this mission was highly classified, they were reminded not to speak a word of it to anyone.